Thank you, and good afternoon, everybody, and good morning to those of you who are calling in from the West Coast. Welcome to the Kaiser Family Foundation's web briefing on Medicare payment and delivery system reforms. My name is Tricia Newman. I'm a Senior Vice President at the Foundation and Director of our Program on Medicare Policy, and I'm very much looking forward to our discussion today. For the past several years, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, mainly through its Innovation Center, has been testing new payment delivery system models with the overarching goal of reducing excess costs while improving or maintaining the quality of patient care. Today, we're going to examine Medicare payment and delivery system models, including ACOs, or accountable care organizations, bundled payments, and medical homes. We're focusing specifically on Medicare models today because Medicare is the single largest payer in the healthcare system, and it has traditionally been a leader and driver of payment system reforms. As of this year, about 1 in 5 Medicare beneficiaries is in some way connected to an ACO or medical home, quite a change when you think about it from just a few years ago, which is among the many reasons we're hosting this briefing today. Over the course of the next hour, we hope to get a better understanding of these models, what they are, how they work, what the evidence tells us about Medicare savings and quality, and what changes might be on tap for the future. We are incredibly fortunate to have a superb set of panelists with us to talk about these issues. I'm going to introduce each of them briefly. My introduction of each speaker will be brief so we can jump right into the discussion, but you can find their full and impressive bios on our web event page. I'll start with Christina Bacuti, an Associate Director of the Kaiser Family Foundation's Program on Medicare Policy. I want to acknowledge Christina and our colleague Shannon Griffin for developing our new online resource, the Evidence Link, which you might want to check out. Next up is Amy Bassano, the Acting Director at the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. The Innovation Center was created by the Affordable Care Act to develop and test new payment and care delivery models in Medicare, Medicaid, and the Children's Health Insurance Program. Farzad Mastashari is the Chief Executive of Al-Adaid, an organization that helps primary care practices become accountable care organizations. Farzad was formerly with the Department of Health and Human Services as the National Coordinator for Health Information Technologies and as a physician in internal medicine. Last but definitely not least is Mark Miller, who has served as the Executive Director of the Medicare Payment Advisory Commission for the past 15 years. MedPAC is an independent government agency that makes recommendations to Congress on Medicare payment policy. So here's the game plan for the briefing. I'm going to kick off the discussion by posing a few questions for panelists, and then we'll turn to questions submitted by listeners. You can submit your questions at any time, and we'll get to as many questions as we possibly can before the hour is up. And here's my promise. I'm going to do what I can to keep this a jargon-free briefing. That is not easy since the topic tends to attract more than its share of acronyms, so I hope my panelists will join me in that challenge. Let's get to it. Let's start with Christina. Christina, can you help lay the groundwork for this discussion? Briefly, if you can, describe the leading Medicare payment delivery system models that have rolled out across the country, ACOs, bundled payments, and medical homes, and give us a sense of what you have found in terms of how well they're working based on the evidence you've seen.
Sure. I'll try to give the one-minute description of each and say a few words on the evidence on savings and quality for them. So starting with ACOs, they're located across the country. Some are led by hospitals, some by physician groups, and some by whole integrated health systems. ACOs are assigned a population of Medicare patients and agree to be collectively responsible for their total Medicare spending and quality, aside from prescription drugs. At the end of the year, Medicare tallies up each ACO's total spending for all their Medicare patients. If an ACO's spending is below its target benchmark and meets quality standards, then it gets some extra money, thereby sharing in these savings with Medicare. About 10% of ACOs are also at risk if their spending exceeds their benchmark, and then they have to pay back some of the so-called loss. So what's the evidence on Medicare savings and quality so far for ACOs? To some extent, the answer depends on how ACOs are evaluated. I'm going to focus on the most recent data that came out last month from CMS, and others here might want to add in other perspectives as well. So for 2016, we see that about a little more than half of ACOs had below benchmark spending. But to look at the net savings to Medicare, I'm going to put up a quick snapshot. So looking at this slide on the screen here, you'll see that at the leftmost bar shows that across all the ACOs, there were net savings of about $47 million in 2016. That's relative to the benchmarks. Net savings, of course, account for Medicare expenditures on both services and bonuses. And to dig a little deeper, the ACOs that don't take on risk, that's the orange bar there, that's really the lion's share of ACOs, they had net costs to Medicare relative to benchmarks of about $70 million when the bonuses are factored in. While the ACOs that did take on risk, those are the blue ones to the right, those had net savings relative to their benchmarks. So I'll note also that if you look at these results and compare them to the year before, they've improved somewhat. There's generally more net savings than there were before. And ACOs that have been in the program longer tend to be more successful, which might be expected. So the bottom line on ACOs is that the evidence on Medicare savings for them has been somewhat mixed and fairly modest, but there's potential for improvements over time as ACOs are scheduled to take on more risk. And in terms of quality, there really hasn't appeared to be major differences between ACOs and non-ACO providers. So I'll quickly move on to bundled payment models. Instead of these models, instead of spending for the whole year, they focus on discrete episodes of care, such as a 90-day period starting with a hip replacement surgery. I'll get to this slide in a minute. In this case, a hospital gets a target amount to cover a surgery, like a hip and knee replacement, which is shown here. But the actual, the target amount that they get covers not just the surgery, but the implant, the doctor fees, and any rehab therapy. And if they save money, they get to keep the savings. And if not, then they owe CMS the difference. So the Innovation Center has been running both voluntary and mandatory bundled payment models. And so these results that are up here focus on one of those models. And these results come from an independent evaluation and shows per episode savings. So you can see that the bar on the far left has the most robust savings for hip and knee replacements, and these follow somewhat from the prior year as well. And you can also see that there are several clinical episodes to the right that show some savings, but these are not statistically significant. So it's trending in that direction, but can't get statistical significance on them. There's also some preliminary results available on a different model, which is the mandatory bundled payment model, and preliminarily, results that have come out have showed that about half of the 800 hospitals have had below benchmark spending. Another note on quality, I'd say that the quality for the model that's up there, these voluntary models, the quality, the independent evaluation didn't detect major problems, particularly with this model, but did show that there were some smaller models that warrant further assessment because of some considerations. So I want to move on quickly to the medical home models. And these medical homes are typically primary care practices, team-based care. The provider coordinates the majority of their patients' care. The theory behind medical homes is that enhanced primary care will lead to later overall savings. The Innovation Center has been focusing on multi-payer models in which Medicare, commercial insurers, and Medicaid are each paying monthly care management fees to medical homes. To date, results on medical homes don't show overall net savings after you account for care management fees, but overall, they do have lower expenditures on services. And results aren't out yet on the newest model, the Comprehensive Primary Care Plus model. And this model has a unique payment structure to meet patients' needs between visits so the patient doesn't need to come into the office as much. And I think many are eager to see the results when those come in and are available. So I just lightning speed went through these three models, and I forgive me for being for oversimplifying them, but we have lots more details on our website, including an interactive tool that lets you compare the models, different features, different results. So I encourage you to go there to find out more.
That's great, and that was lightning speed. And, I'm going to move on to Amy. Amy, I want to thank you for joining us, and I also want to thank you for all the work that you're doing. And I appreciate you taking the time to be with us. So I suspect the top question on the minds of many people in our audience is whether or how the priorities of the Innovation Center might be changing with the new administration. Can you give us a sense of what we might expect to see in the future? Are there new models or hot spots of interest that might be coming our way?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me here. I'm really excited to be here and be part of this conversation. And Christina, in particular, thank you for doing such a fabulous job of explaining our models, our three major Medicare models in a very jargon-free, I think, easy-to-explain way. I appreciate all the work of the foundation to help spread the word of our work. As many people may know, the CMS put out a request for information on a new direction of the Innovation Center earlier this year in September. The comment period on it just closed last week. We received more than 1,000 comments. We are sorting through all of those comments and trying to understand all of them and see how they align with the work that we, or the ideas we discussed in the RFI. I'll quickly tick through them just for people's reference. The first is more opportunities in advanced alternative payment models, and these are models where you can receive an additional, physicians can receive an additional financial incentive for taking on risk and participating in these models. Consumer-directed care and market-based innovation models, physician specialty models. We really want to be able to bring physicians into these models and have opportunities for them. We currently have our oncology care model, but want to be doing more work in this space, and there's an advisory committee to the secretary that also works with us and gives us ideas for models there. Prescription drug models, an area that is clearly important to the administration. The president himself has talked about wanting to do work in the prescription drug space. Medicare innovation models. We have some models in Medicare Advantage. We've just announced last week sort of a more opportunities in that for our VBID model, our value-based incentive program model, allowing participation in for more plans. And then state-based, which we aren't really talking about so much today because we're focusing on the Medicare, but we do think that Medicare and Medicaid work together in many models. Also mental and behavioral health, and then program integrity. So we have eight areas of model design we are looking for comments on. So I think we are interested in pursuing models in those spaces. We're sort of in the information gathering area right now. As I said, got many comments on the RFI, getting through them, and really excited about the level of interest and engagement we have in our existing partners and partners, people who are interested in being partners with us going forward. So I think over the coming months, expect to see more us rolling out more models in those particular areas.
Great. That's great. And obviously, all the speakers can come back to each other if there are things that anybody has said that you want to comment on. Farzad, if I could turn to you. So there's been some positive news about physician-led ACOs, as I'm sure you're well aware and happy to hear. And I have a few related questions for you. Can you give us your perspective on what's driving the success of physician-led ACOs? Okay, wait, two more. So
yes.
Just bundle them all together, so to speak. Second, can you talk to us about what are the challenges involved of having physicians actually try to drive changes in behavior of other providers? Because that must be difficult, not only to get physicians to do it themselves, but also to make hospitals change their behavior, specialists or post-acute providers. And then I suspect you want to talk about how ACO savings are evaluated. So maybe if you could comment about that.
Great. Let me start actually with that one. We saw some of the summary statistics as was reported most recently. I think it's important to add a couple points for context. The first is, yes, not all ACOs and the results of all are not the same. And in particular, as was mentioned, the longer you're doing this, the better you are at it, and the better results the taxpayer is getting from it. So there's a really a very steady and improvement in the amount of savings that compared to the benchmark that are reported between, you know, the freshmen, the 100 freshman ACOs that started, their aggregate spending was only $5 million below their benchmark. So that's not very much. The 85 sophomores, it was $50 million below their benchmark. The 74 seniors, though, saved Medicare $204 million. And if you look at the 73 kind of most experienced ACOs, their savings are now up to nearly $300 million a year. And for that, for those groups, the seniors and those who are now 4 years into the program, 5 years into the program, in aggregate, they got $500 million of savings compared to the benchmark, and they got back from the government $350 million for that. So the government was ahead $150 million. That's the kind of trend that I think is really important as we're doing these delivery reform activities. We got to be patient. Like, this stuff takes time. You know, healthcare didn't get messed up in a day, and it's not going to be fixed in a day either. And I think it is really, really important for us when we start initiatives like this to, yes, iterate and tweak and so forth, but to give it the time it needs in communities, in the ACOs, to make the changes that we're seeing. So the worst thing possible would be to say, well, in aggregate, you know, we're paying out a lot of money and this isn't working, and let's do the next great thing, right? We got to give these time. The other point that was mentioned is, yes, there's a big difference between hospital and physician-only ACOs. So if you look at the distribution, roughly of those who had increased costs compared to the benchmark versus decreased costs, right, whether or not they're liable for those costs, they're no risk, not at risk or at risk. On the hospital-led ACOs, 25% were statistically above the threshold, 25% were statistically below the threshold, 50% overall had cost increases, 50%, it was almost like a perfect normal distribution. On the physician-led ACOs, it was 3-1. Three times as many were in the statistically significant savings as they were. And that, I think, gets to your point. I do want to put another pin in for quality, though. One of the major concerns around the program had been, like, are people going to save money? Am I going to get less as a patient? Is my mom going to get less care? They're saving money. Surely, you know, if they're spending less money, then I must be getting less. And what people are getting less of is like, fewer hospitalizations, right? So even if the government then has turned around and paid somebody for having reduced those hospital admissions and that utilization, that's a good thing. Right? It's a positive thing that savings, those savings have come from reducing post-acute care and acute care, particularly on the physician-led ACO side. And it hasn't come at the expense of quality. In fact, I think the data that Medicare has previously discussed has said that when you have the same quality measures measured with ACOs and the fee-for-service population, they have been better in those in the ACOs. You asked, though, very specifically about the group that we work with most closely is the physician-led. And it is very hard for groups of physicians to come together and do this. But when they do, they're very successful, I think mostly because they're bought in, they're engaged. You know, we talk about, like, some ACO, hospital-led ACOs, the physicians aren't even sure if they're in an ACO or not. Right? Like, well, that's not going to work. Right, you really need the physician. And that's the biggest thing you get from this is the engagement of the frontline clinical workers who are seeing the patients and really getting engaged on this issue of stewardship of the total healthcare dollar, not just their cost, but the whole system being the quarterback for the patient. And the most important group, as you mentioned, is the primary care providers. And the groups that we work with, they want the football. They want to be accountable for the total cost of care. They don't. What they need help with is the capital, the resources, the startup cost, the technology, the workflow coaching that goes into it, the information on what's going on with their patient, the understanding of how other people are treating the patients. They need all of that. But what makes them successful is their relationship, closeness to the patient, and closeness to the way the decisions are being made that impact downstream care.
Great, thank you. Mark, you're pretty good at assessing evidence on Medicare payments and savings, and you've heard a bit about what we've heard so far, that the evidence, at least on ACOs, is mixed but modest. There are signs of improvement, as far as I just was talking about, over time with the sophomores, juniors, seniors, and graduates. In your view, should the Innovation Center continue to push forward with ACOs? How optimistic are you that they will achieve more than just modest savings? And what's your take on this, on the potential success of bundled payments in medical homes to achieve even greater savings?
Okay, so a couple things. I think the Commission's view of ACOs is that CMMI and the provider should continue to push ahead with ACOs. It's true that the evidence is mixed, and I would have said exactly what you said, Christina, that using CMS's benchmarks, the risk-based models tend to show small savings. The one-sided models tend not to. As far as I've known, Mike McWilliams and Cherno and that crowd use a different approach, and they feel that there are modest savings across the board, much like you show as well. So I think, you know, the notion that they're producing some level of savings is true, and that the fact they are, in fact, modest. But I also think in a world where relative utilization growth is slowed down, you know, maybe that's the kind of results that you might expect. So I think the Commission's view is that there is something here, should keep moving forward. The Commission has done work where we've looked at different marketplaces. We don't necessarily think ACOs will be successful or should necessarily be a model in every market. Some markets may be better for managed care plan, some better for fee-for-service, some straight fee-for-service, and some for ACOs. But I think there would still be, I think the Commission is still interested in this model and has done a ton of work to keep, you know, to give guidance to CMS and to the Congress on how to think about things going forward. And actually, CMS has been fairly responsive to the guidance in developing its new models, and so that's greatly appreciated. I agree that the evidence seems to be that small ACOs are doing better. I do have caution. We've talked about this before, Farzad. I think the single thing that explains the success of an ACO is its starting benchmark. If you have a higher benchmark, you do better, and that's the single, probably most important factor that drives things in terms of just aggregate results. I think some of the physician stuff has occurred in areas of the country that had relatively high benchmarks, but even controlling for that, they do come out a little bit ahead of the hospital. I don't think it's quite as much as people at first blush see, but I still think there's something there. The longevity, I think it's probably true they get better. I think the evidence is clear that they get better as they go. But the other thing I hear from them is this concern about, well, how long can I keep this up? And that's probably something that you hear as well. So I think that's a question. I've never been optimistic about anything in my life.
Right? Yeah. That's why I love asking you the question.
All right, but I mean, I am trying to convey that I think there's something there, and I don't think it's abandon and move on. I definitely don't think that. I think the other parts of your questions was bundling and medical home, and I'll be brief. On bundling, the Commission is I want to be very clear, we're not opposed to this idea, but there is some concerns that attach to it. The commission is generally likes the ideas of models that look across the entire experience of the beneficiary over time across providers. Bundles don't do that by definition. They create an incentive to control cost, and I'm leaving quality out of the conversation. Sorry, Farzad, for the moment, out of the conversation. They create incentives to control cost in the bundle, but there's always a question of how many bundles, and so that's an issue. And then just from an administrative point of view, and I wouldn't want to have your job, Amy, if you have a bunch of bundled initiatives running and the beneficiaries in a bundle and in an ACO or in a bundle and not in an ACO and the providers in the ACO but not in the bundle, but you know, in every permutation, how do you attribute? And I think the commission has had some conversations about that, and mostly the conversations have been this is pretty complicated and pretty hard, and in some ways want to default to more of the aggregate model, you know, and then let, you know, attributions of savings work from there. The last thing I'll say about the medical home is the commission looked at it for a while, and it's exactly as Christina said. It's a very logical and obvious model, and the evidence is just not produced around it. I think it probably makes a lot of sense for a managed care organization or an ACO to use the medical home to help manage underneath a larger model. And in an odd way, the commission is kind of embrace the idea without really embracing the medical home notion. The commission in the physician fee schedule has made recommendations to pay primary care on a per part of the payments for primary care on a per patient basis rather than a per service basis in order to free up the primary care practitioner to do coordination and that type of thing, but then hasn't attached all the performance requirements to it. And I think we're at a more simplistic point of saying the fee schedule doesn't support primary care because it's too service oriented, and have tried to move the fee schedule in that direction, which is not quite the medical home concept, but kind of. Stop there.
Great. Before I start with some other questions, anybody want to comment on what anybody else has said? All right, well, Let me move on a little bit. Let me get Amy back to you for a sec. So earlier, Christina talked about savings associated with the hip and knee replacement bundles. Yet the proposed rule that came out last summer would pare down the ongoing model by making it voluntary in many areas. Can you help our audience understand the administration's thinking and proposing to cut back on the model?
Sure. I think there was a sense of wanting to give providers more opportunity to be flexible and to allow to elect to join in and not to require them to do it. So I'd say we're still in rulemaking on that. So it was a proposed rule. Stay tuned shortly for a final rule on that where we can talk more about it. But really the idea is the administration did not want to be requiring so many providers to be in this model for a number of reasons. One, provider flexibility. Two, the sort of scope of the model and how many areas it was, which sort of gets to something that Mark talked about, sort of the overlap of models, something we think about not just in CJR, but other models as well. Of they are modeled by definition from the Innovation Center, meaning they are tests. We need to be able to evaluate them, and how do we tease out the impacts of any particular intervention and have a comparison group, and how do we study that? And so what is the right size of a model to get that information before we scale it more broadly? And so we do spend a lot of time thinking about how do the models overlap with each other, whether in the intent of the model, the geographic areas where the model participants are, and how do we attribute the savings or other impacts of the model. So all of those, sort of to get to your question, was sort of why, you know, why we were scaling back on CJR. Really appreciate everyone's comments who they've made on that and some of the other provisions of that proposed rule as well. And like I said, sort of stay tuned for a final rule on that shortly.
Great. Let's go to another question. Some of you commented on the fact that ACOs and I guess some of the other demos exclude prescription drugs. And prescription drugs are obviously an important part of the healthcare equation. What's your thinking about whether it makes sense to keep drugs is a separately paid for part of the healthcare system, or whether it should be more integrated into these delivery system reforms that we're talking about today. Really, anybody.
So I can talk about it from just a pure operational perspective of what we do at the Innovation Center. I think we'd like to be able to incorporate that more, but just operationally to get the information from the Part D plans on a claim-by-claim basis or information that we can then attribute back to the ACO or the patient is sort of operationally complex. We've started to dip our toe in that area in our oncology care model about looking at some of the reinsurance for the highest cost drugs. But I think that's more work we intend to be doing to think about how we can incorporate, when you're looking at total cost of care, truly looking at all of their costs across the entire spectrum of what Medicare pays for. So it's just a technical operational issue for reasons that we can't do it in many of our models.
And I think I can understand both, you know, why ACOs started where they are with just A, B. I can also understand technically how difficult it is. You know, logically, I think you do want a connection ultimately. And I think the couple of ideas, and I mean, these are very just notions, hardly ideas, that I've heard floating around are the one that you almost seem to be saying, Amy, where you look at the attributed population and compute utilization for that attributed population, and then in some way reward or penalize the ACO depending on how it does for that attributed population. Now, an ACO immediately should say, but I don't have any control or relationship with those PDPs, and so, I mean, with the freestanding drug plans.
Well done.
Sorry about that. And so, you know, that would be like a hard bridge to cross. The other idea, which I think is an interesting idea, and I don't even know whether you can think about it from a demonstration point of view, is the notion of establishing a freestanding drug plan that's peculiar to people who are in ACOs. And so if somebody is attributed to an ACO, you say to them, by the way, you know, this is a drug plan that is associated with your ACO. And I don't mean having one for each ACO, maybe having one drug plan that serves a range of ACOs and actually does have something of a relationship, and the beneficiary is either encouraged in some way to pick that plan, and then the plan would be somewhat more in sync with the ACO. But again, that's more of a notion than an actual idea.
Maybe if I can take the thread and make a slightly different point. The issue we're getting at is who has leverage, who has influence, and what are the benefit designs, right? So what are the beneficiary incentives and that come to bear here? And what's really interesting about the range of work that we've done, we have Medicare Fee-for-Service and the Medicare Shared Savings Program, where there's really, in many cases, almost zero, like, incentive design. Like, there's nothing, but they have a lot of them, 85% have medical supplements, they can go anywhere they want, they don't have to go to, you know, they're really totally, you know, there's no incentive design to speak up there. And we're just using the influence of the primary care provider on the patient and that relationship that they really believe and trust that they're acting in their best interest. Now we have commercial relationships, and we have about a dozen commercial shared savings contracts where the health plan, unlike Medicare, does a whole bunch of stuff, right? They have incentive design in there, but they also have services that they're offering, and they'll send someone to the house and they'll do this and that. And then the coordination between what the health plan is doing, right? We don't have that problem with Medicare because Medicare's not doing anything. But with the commercial plan, there's now a coordination problem with who's in charge of this. Is it the plan's plan, stuff that they're doing, or is it the primary care doctor's assumed accountability for the cost, including around drug costs? And what's really interesting now is we have this third experience where we are actually doing a joint venture with a new health plan where we are together crafting in an aligned way what we want the doc to tell the patient should have an incentive to do. So if we're telling the doc to do a well visit, because that's really good for the patient, well, why don't we give the patient an incentive, right? Like, we'll knock something off your deductible if you come in to get an annual wellness visit done. Or if we want them to go to the specialists that are higher value, higher performing specialists, we'll knock something off, or we'll give you free transportation if you can go there. So, and you can do that much more with Medicare Advantage now with the value-based incentive design and the flexibility that's been introduced there. So I think the big picture here is we're talking about sharing risk between the payers, the health plans, Medicare, and the physicians. But what we're talking about sharing data, that's a good start. But what you really need to get to grips on this is aligned incentives between and thoughtfulness between all three parties, the payer, the patient, and the providers.
Can I say one thing about that?
Absolutely.
We made a suggestion. CMS definitely in the next generation, I believe,
yes,
tried to reflect this. We were saying that if the beneficiary goes to their ACO, primary care,
yeah,
physician, forgive their copayment. And you guys had to operationalize it using the cash,
right,
thing.
We pay them.
Right.
The beneficiary.
Right.
Sorry.
It's a direct payment to the beneficiary. Yeah.
Right. But that was the notion, and I'm just trying to, you know, say that I agree that, you know, you do have to get all three actors aligned, and that was at least one way in the ACO to get the beneficiary.
And I would just add that I think that is also one of the parts that the administration in our new direction, RFI, is really trying to emphasize, is sort of adding the patient, the beneficiary, into the mix, that they haven't necessarily been part of the active decision-making or management in many of these models, and wanting to launch models where they are having more choices and more information about the care they are getting. And so agree completely that they need to be front and center in all of this.
That's great. I want to pick up on a few questions that we've had on this exact topic, which is, how should patients think about this? And I'd like to bring it back home. And for that, you mentioned before about what's in the interest of patients. So if my mom went to her doctor and found out that he was affiliated with an ACO, or she's affiliated with an ACO, and she came home and she said, "That's great, but what's this? And is it good? Is it not good? What should I know? What are the opportunities here? What are the risks? What are the financial incentives involved? What should my mom know? What will make it, what's in her best interest to learn in this experience? And how would I explain to her whether or not this is good for her, what she should ask, what are the issues involved?" And I'm going to turn to Christina to kick this one off.
Sure. Well, if your mom came to you with that statement, she probably heard it from her, she was probably informed to some extent from her doctor, because Medicare isn't required now to be notifying beneficiaries if they're in an ACO. And frankly, the patient or your mom wouldn't really know, she could not know that she's in an ACO, because her care wouldn't change that much. Like Farzad said, she's still in traditional Medicare and still can see, you know, it's still in her doctor's caseload and can see what doctors he or she, you know, your mom wants, the cost-sharing rates don't really change, aside from some new initiatives that are coming out, which is that $25 payment to see ACO providers. And also what's coming up a little bit is the voluntary alignment, where the patients can go to a computer and sort of click some indication that they want to be affiliated with a certain doctor that they consider their main doctor. So I think there is something going on to push towards more patient engagement, but it wouldn't really explain to your mom what an ACO is.
Right.
And I think we all know it's challenging to explain to anyone what an ACO is. But you could say to her that, you know, on the one hand, these are models that if they achieve their goals, are designed to lower Medicare spending to some degree and improve quality, which could help Medicare's fiscal situation and maybe lower their total out-of-pocket costs. But on the other hand, you might also want to say to your mom that she should talk to her doctor about why she's being recommended to go to certain specialists and certain or post-acute care, particularly if she has strong preferences about where she wants to go. So those are some of the questions you could tell somebody if they're saying, I'm in an ACO, what should I know? And then to keep in mind that really, you know, even if you say that the savings are there, that they're still figuring that out. So that's my two cents I'd add in. Others certainly.
All right, well,
I think patients should be informed if they're in fee for service, that they're in fee for service, and the motivation of the health system around doing more to them. But the point I'm making is that we take for granted the incentive structures, the perverse incentive structures that we are living in right now. And we say, oh, there's this new thing, like now we got to protect people from the risks of this new thing, right? And it's like, well, what are the risks of the old thing, you know? And there are, you know, there's lots of excess unnecessary care that is somehow strangely associated with things that make people money. So I think part of the thing that gets in here is like, well, should people have to like opt into being in an ACO? And other than, I just want to put that to rest like as quickly as I possibly can. All that would do is it would introduce a whole lot of more busy work, paperwork, administrative burden to the doctor to try to do these new models. It actually wouldn't provide any additional engagement of patients with this or protection for them. What I hope the patients will feel when their physician joins an ACO is, I can get to see my patient more, my doc more quickly. I can call them and someone answers the phone. The answering machine actually directs to a person. I get called after I go to the emergency room. I get a visit right after I come out of the hospital. My doc knows stuff about me. When I get care, when I end up in the hospital, my doc hears about it and knows about it. They're more informed about my care. And somehow, they seem to care more about my total experience in healthcare. That's what I want the patient to feel. Not that, oh, you are now a member of this thing that I didn't even know what it is. Because I know for my parents, they just get confused by that. And what I want to do is I want to make sure that the relationship with their primary care doc is strengthened, not something else comes in between and it's like now there's this other thing between you and your primary care.
You make it sound like concierge medicine without the additional huge fee.
Well, the incentives are there, right? If you are a primary care doc who wants to control total cost of care, you do all those things. I know because we do all those things now and our practices weren't before for the most part.
I think the beneficiary should know, and if they're attributed to an ACO, they should know that. I think it's back to getting alignment if they have no idea they're even involved in it. I think it's hard to do that. I think another thing, you could think of attribution into ACOs on the basis of a beneficiary declaring that they have this person as their primary care physician, and then say if that physician is attributed or is part of an ACO, be attributed on that basis. And then I think that strengthens the relationship with the primary care physician. I do think dollars matter, and if the beneficiary could see something from the transaction, a forgiven copayment, something that helps, which we are already talked about. And then because I assume I'm asked to these things to say something depressing, I think, you know, a big problem in the fee-for-service environment generally and in ACOs, because ACOs are still fee-for-service, is if you have very first-dollar Medigap arrangements, then it's very hard to send signals to the beneficiary through their cost sharing. And, you know, we've talked about this. I won't go on and on about it. But even small adjustments in which the beneficiary sees something when they go and receive a service, and it does not have to be large, that signal can be a lot clearer. But if it's first dollar, then it gets hard to send a signal to the beneficiary.
Yeah, I would just add that, you know, we want the patients to know what kind of care they're getting, what choices are available to them, and it's not just, you know, goes beyond, you know, their relationship with their individual physician, but thinking about on bundles where there's a lot of post-acute care, having people make sure they understand what their options are and what's available to them. So we think a lot about that and trying to improve upon that, what we can do to make people aware of their options and understand what's happening around them, and to also align the incentives to make sure they're also committed to the, you know, the work that's being done, and making sure they understand what their financial incentives are. But as Mark says, with first dollar coverage, is often they don't often don't see it. But so thinking about different ways, whether it be the waiver we have in place to pay patients for going to their primary care, or other types of incentives, thinking about using our authority to make sure they, you know, how can they get engaged and be part of it, but also how can we also make sure they're getting all the services they need.
All right. We have a very straightforward question, which is, what are the major sources of savings in ACOs?
Usually comes from reduced hospitalization services talked about earlier. If you keep someone out of a hospital, that is pretty easy to start achieving those savings, because that's the largest cost driver. Reduced use or in post-acute care, or different types of services in post-acute care, getting someone home faster, all of those can drive savings a lot. You know, those savings are where they add up.
And the only thing I would have said exactly those two things, and I think McWilliams has had some work on the post-acute care point. The other thing, and, you know, we're talking Medicare, I know it's a Medicare thing, but, you know, on the commercial side, they also had some original early success in the first ACO-type operations of directing people to lower-cost providers, lower providers that charged less. But that's all commercial, not Medicare.
How does all of this work, this is another question, in rural America? Is this more of an urban phenomenon, or does this work well in rural settings?
So I don't think it has to, I don't think it has to be just in urban phenomenon. So there's a group, it's run by Lynn Barr, the name of which is escaping me right
now. Caravan. Caravan?
Yeah, Caravan, mm-hmm. That's it. That, you know, basically, and it's, I don't think it's completely dissimilar to what you're about, Farzad, but knitting, you know, small practices together and trying to do a lot of the backroom operation for the rural practices. And so certainly the notion of trying to do that in rural areas is at least one thing that's going on out there.
We have a bunch of, going into 20 ACOs now, and about half of them are in pretty rural areas, at least in part, you know, Kansas and rural Mississippi and so forth. And the way it's different, I guess, is there's no question that your primary care doc is the quarterback of the patient's care. Like, there ain't no one else there. In Malvern, Arkansas, there's two primary care docs. They own that population. They're accountable for that population, whether, you know, whether they like it or not. They're on call every other night. So I think that idea of I'm responsible for my patient's care and the totality of their care makes an easier fit. They get that. They're also, interestingly, very concerned about the survival of their rural hospitals. And they're, you know, they get worried when we start really reducing hospitalizations. Like they get worried about, like, what's this, you know, how can we actually work with our local hospital to preserve and strengthen their financial situation. The one area where it is two areas. One is there's less choice around specialists. And those special ones, the patient goes to the U, they start ping-ponging around, it gets very expensive. So I think thinking ahead, finding some way, whether it's, you know, telemedicine in those rural hospitals or other ways to get kind of specialist care, you know, in place in those rural areas without having the patient have to drive 5 hours, is an opportunity. But the other thing that you get in those rural areas that's very hard is if you get consolidation. and you can get consolidation anywhere, right?
Mm-hmm.
Look at Boston. But it's particularly bad in rural areas when you get consolidation and there's kind of one big behemoth health system that, you know, owns all healthcare for that region, and they start to really use their muscle on the independent practices to get referrals in and to get the to get them to join their clinically integrated network. And we've seen some kind of anti-competitive behavior in rural areas that are just so blatant that you wouldn't normally have expected. Like they're not too shy about it. So that is a, and you know, I think the whole issue of consolidation and competition is something that, you know, Medicare maybe used to be cared less about, but the shows in the commercial, on the commercial side, is a very, very big problem for, you know, moving from volume to value.
Well, I hope it's come through from the commission that the consolidation is a huge issue, because it does drive up commercial prices. Then Medicare has to chase those prices, and we don't think those prices are particularly efficient. And then on the,
an understatement, efficient understatement.
Well, I was trying to be more, you know, socially acceptable. The other thing I would say about the rural hospital, and this will be just a quick commercial, we have another idea, because admissions in rural areas have been falling a lot, I mean, even separate from any of this phenomenon. And a lot of small rural hospitals with the census that they have just cannot cover those costs. And so we have this new idea that we've been talking about. If you're an isolated hospital, whether you take, and all of Medicare subsidies are tied to inpatient mm-hmm. admissions, take some block of that dollars, give it to the community as a way to kind of subsidize the mission, and then abandon the inpatient mission, make it more of a 24-hour emergency room, and then transport, you know, to this would be where there's another hospital that you could, and then you get better, more volume in the other hospital, and probably better outcomes. But it's a notion that we've been talking about just recently.
Right, and that builds off of some of the work that our model with Pennsylvania is doing in rural hospitals as well. That mm-hmm. that concept of, do you need the inpatient beds? Is that what the services that are needed in this community? Or is it more, you know, a community clinic and other type of work, and other places that could be doing your hip replacements, knee replacements, other surgical procedures, and where, you know, where do you go? So I think we're very interested in the rural issues. Something I should say here, and applies to many of the issues we talked about, is even though the Innovation Center is doing work on these, a lot of these are sort of agency-wide efforts, and that we're using, testing our authority, but there are efforts underway under the fee-for-service side and other levers we have as the agency as a whole, and I think certainly we are looking at a broader rural strategy as how we can address many of these issues across fee-for-service and the Innovation Center as well, and also using our waiver authority, which allows us to change or take away some payment requirements. And so whether we allow more home visits by non-physicians mm-hmm. or more use of telehealth or waiving the 3-day stay requirement to get into a skilled nursing facility. So those are not necessarily specifically directed to rural, but I think that they could be particularly helpful in model for model participants who are in rural areas to give them more flexibility to deliver the services.
And just one last comment. In terms of iterating policy, it is really important that we consider how the general, you know, you can say on average this policy is going to be fine, but if it disproportionately comes down on the rural providers, rural ACOs, and many of, there are at least three issues that are iterations that need to be made to the regulations that are currently disadvantaging the rural ACOs, and I think it's too much detail to go into, but I just want to just have said that we do need to iterate these when we learn more things about the impact these are going to have on the likelihood of people getting rewarded for the work that they're doing. We need to continually be looking for tweaking, and it's very technocratic, it's very much in the weeds, very actuarial and hard to understand, but that is the work that needs to continue to happen.
Which is what Medicare's been doing in payment policy from the get-go. Amy, I have another question for you. We have listeners who are interested in the Medicare Diabetes Prevention Program. So can you tell us a little bit about what this program has done, how and why you've decided to move forward and expand on it?
Sure.
In January?
April. So, it was initially scheduled for.
Can you just explain what it does?
Sure.
Evidence of its success.
So we had a test early on of the in the Innovation Center's history or tenure, about going back a few years, with the YUSA on a program they've had for a long time and works with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that looks at patients who are pre-diabetic and have a certain overweight or obese and helps them lose weight and keep the weight off. And the evidence shows that this does save the program money to keep them from becoming diabetic. So we had tested this out earlier on and saw the really positive results, and our actuary said, yes, this will save the Medicare program money. So under our authority of the Innovation Center, we can expand and scale models who meet those requirements. And so the secretary certified this along with the actuaries. And so last year we started the process of expanding this and making this a broader model that's open to all eligible Medicare participants. By law, we have to go through rulemaking. So we went through two rounds of rulemaking on this and now created a new type of supplier who can come in and offer this program. It, as I said, the CDC sort of has designed or runs the actual curriculum and oversees what it should look like. And so participants or the suppliers would be certified by the CDC to offer this sort of weight loss and management. And so program, there's very specific criteria about what you need to be doing. And then we would be making a payment for it. It's interesting and exciting because it's a value and outcome-based payment that is tied to sustain the weight loss and keeping the weight off over a period of time. And so we finished the rulemaking on this, and this year's physician fee schedule rulemaking, which came out the beginning of this month, and so will become available for patient beneficiaries in April. The suppliers can come and enroll in the program, and then this is available to anyone who meets the criteria, and they can talk to their physician about it and be able to look up who the suppliers are in their community who could help them with this.
Great. I think I have time for one last question. A lot of this got started because there was concern about high-need, high-cost people in traditional Medicare, right? And what were we going to do to lower their costs and improve quality? But it was more about the 10% that accounted for the 60% of spending. Do we know that ACOs right now are really addressing the small share that account for a significant amount of spending, or are the savings kind of coming across the board? In other words, are ACOs sort of going after that population that has been of such concern?
Well, there are a lot of researchers who think that we're focusing too much on them, and we should be focusing more on not doing low-value services. I think that you need a blended approach. I don't think you can just focus on that, that top of that pyramid. I do think that you need a deeper approach to look at preventing, the wellness, the referral management, the, unnecessary services. So if anything, I think the fault has been too much saying, let's just sprinkle some care managers on top and then we're going to be fine.
Yeah, I'm not aware of evidence or, a systematic study that says, the ACOs are focusing on, or the savings are coming from, or the effects are coming from there. Although in conversations with different ACOs, this is a little bit dated now, they seem to have different strategies about how they were going after things, preventing hospitalization, focusing on post-acute care, and some of them specifically said, we're going after this population of people who have chronic conditions. And remember that, 10% or 15% or whatever the number is, there are different, and I know you know this, Tricia, but I mean, there are different populations in that. I mean, your ability to manage some of those populations are not always present. Some of them are in their last 6 months of life and that type of thing. So I don't know if there's systematic evidence. I know some of the ACOs, we're, defining them as a priority.
Right. I agree. Our models are total cost of care and looking at the outcomes. We're not particularly prescriptive on how you get there. And so I think the ACOs are all taking different approaches depending upon their populations they have to manage. And I think as sort of was said earlier, the longer you're at this, the more you have, the more you can refine your approaches and thinking about it and maybe feel more confident in taking on more of a broader population and being, you know, looking at not just those, you know, people who are about to go in the hospital and keep them out, but, you know, managing the entire population. So we give flexibility on how they do that, but it does seem that that's probably where they would be. But as Mark said, I'm not aware of any specific research in that area.
Yeah, I'd end in, I'm not either, and I think that's curious that we haven't had some paper about CHF and or congestive heart failure. And what's being done. I think we do see some case studies, and we see what some ACOs are doing individually, and that's helpful. I would also mention it's an issue for medical homes, too. You know, like they're managing the care, too, and what are they doing for high-cost, high-need patients. So I think that would be good. I think the Innovation Center has also managed the Independence at Home project, which has a focus on frail elderly people and getting care at home. And that might give some insights on what it takes to care for really high-need, high-cost patients.
And there's certainly work that's ongoing with the nursing home population. There's the dual nursing home, dual meaning people eligible for Medicare and Medicaid nursing home demonstration, which is a population that's comprised of high users of medical services and needs more attention. And of course, there are the broader dual demos, many of the people who are highest need.
Right. So there are specific models that target that. I'd also add, in addition to independent home, there are a number of model proposals that have gone to the Secretary's Advisory Committee, the PTAC, on the physician mm-hmm. models. And so I think there's a lot of interest from the physician community and the broader, you know, the provider community as well to be doing work in this space and addressing their particular needs.
So I think we are at the end of our hour, and I want to thank all of the panelists for a really, really interesting discussion. We could go on. There are more questions that I haven't gotten to from many listeners, but we are at the end of the hour. So thank you very, very much. And for those of you who are listening, the transcripts will be posted within 24 hours on our website, so check back. And if you've missed a few, if you had to leave the room to get a cup of coffee, come on back and hear what our panelists had to say. Thanks so much for joining us.